This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome to our continuing coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. We're at day number 20 of the trial of Alex Murdaugh here on the 22nd of February, 2023. Let's head to the courtroom for our first segment of coverage.
Good morning. Ready for the jury?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Griffin has a matter he wishes to address with the court.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Your Honor. We are discussing with Mr. Murdaugh his right to testify or not testify. And one of the issues that has come up is the scope of cross-examination that the state would be permitted to go into should he testify. And the basic rule is when the defendant takes a stand, he waives his Fifth Amendment privilege as to matters to which he testifies on direct and relevant matters subject to cross-examination. Your Honor has let in, over our objection, evidence under 404B of financial misconduct, and what we're asking is for an order excluding the state from being able to question Mr. Murdaugh on cross-examination matters related to the financial crimes that's been put before the court under Rule 404B if we don't testify about those on direct examination. And we need a ruling from the court at some point in time today before tomorrow. We're not putting him up today, but we're asking that we be able to advise him of what the state will be permitted to go into on cross-examination should he choose to testify.
In order for us to
adequately advise him and for him to adequately waive his right and his Fifth Amendment privilege and testify or not. And that's what we're asking.
Would you like for me to review with him at this time his right to testify or not testify?
No. Not at this point in time, Your Honor. We have to, we're trying to get an understanding from the court as to the parameters of the waiver of the privilege. Is he waiving, if he testifies about the murders, is he then subject to cross-examination about the financial crimes? That's what we're asking.
All right. Mr. Waters.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. First of all, obviously the general rule is that cross is generally wide open, and that goes for a defendant who testifies. Your Honor, Rule 611B on the scope of cross-examination expressly says that a witness may be cross-examined on any matter relevant to any issue in the case. And of course, Your Honor has ruled through 404 and 403 the financial matters independently relevant. But the rule goes on to further say, including credibility. So even if that had not happened, these matters which go right to the heart of the credibility and frankly the extensive dishonesty of this defendant would be relevant if he took the stand anyway, regardless of the 404. So independently under that rule of the credibility aspect, it would be admissible under Rule 611B. But again, Your Honor has ruled these matters as relevant in the case, and so they're clearly within the scope of cross. Your Honor, citing State v. Gilbert and Gleaton, 273 SC 690, they said right there, as I think the defense recognized, when the accused takes the stand on his own behalf, he waives his privilege against compulsory self-incrimination and must answer all proper questions. Your Honor, Taylor v. State, which I believe may have been overruled on other grounds, but 258 SC 369, when the appellate elected to testify, he waived his right against self-incrimination and became subject to cross-examination like any other witness. And then finally, citing the U.S. Supreme Court, Brown v. U.S. 356 U.S. 148, it says, talking about a defendant in a criminal case, it says if he takes the stand and testifies in his own defense, his credibility may be impeached and his testimony assailed like any other witness, and the breadth of his waiver is determined by the scope of relevant cross-examination. He has no right to set forth to the jury all the facts which tend in his favor without lying himself open to a cross-examination on those facts. Those are the general and well-established rules, Your Honor, and they're particularly relevant in this case, and so we believe that those financial matters would be well within the scope of this particular matter and authorized by the rules in the case law.
All right, Mr. Griffin.
Yeah, just briefly, Your Honor, with regard to credibility, I mean, the rules are pretty strict as to what evidence of criminal conduct can be used to impeach a witness's credibility, and there are limited to convictions, and that's Rule 609. Your Honor has let the financial evidence in under theory of motive, and you've done a 403 weighing test. And Your Honor, I think when you get to cross-examination of a defendant, I think Your Honor has discretion under Rule 403 to prohibit the state from further inquiry in this case on the financial evidence, which they contend is, you know, a motivating factor for the crimes. And that's and so the Brown v. U.S. and all the, I don't disagree that that's the black letter law, but the question is, you know, what's the scope of cross-examination? And here he's charged with murder. He's not charged with financial crimes. He's charged with murder. And we're asking the court to limit the, you know, the waiver of his Fifth Amendment privilege to the murder charges.
Yes, sir.
You know, again, moving back to 607, of course, the credibility of the witness may be attacked by any party. 608B allows examination, a cross-examination of a witness concerning their aspects of truthfulness and untruthfulness, which this clearly goes to, as well as 608C, which talks about bias, prejudice, and any motive to misrepresent. And again, we're not just talking about purely dishonesty and credibility, which I think is alone more than enough. We're also talking about examination on issues that are specifically relevant to this particular case based on the 404 ruling.
Rule 607, Rule 608, particularly the portion of 608, see evidence of bias, prejudice, or any motive to misrepresent by may be shown to impeach the witness, either by examination of the witness or by evidence otherwise deduced. Rule 611 and 609 also addresses the issue. I am not going to issue an order in advance limiting the scope of cross-examination. Any objectionable matter must be addressed as the evidence is presented and not based on any advance ruling by the court.
Your Honor, the request for the ruling is not an evidentiary ruling. It's the scope of his privilege. And so would he be permitted to assert the Fifth, for example, if they're permitted to ask questions such as they intend to on cross? And that's,
I can't give you an advisory opinions about the evidence and the scope of cross-examination, the scope of his privilege. I'm willing to review with him the scope of his privilege against self-incrimination, if that's what you're referring to.
We will certainly need to have that colloquy at some point at the end of the day, perhaps. But
for the court to issue some blanket order limiting the scope of cross-examination, that's unheard of to me.
Again, Your Honor, I'm not, the question is the scope of the waiver of his privilege when he gets on that witness stand. That's what we're asking for, not an evidentiary ruling.
Well, Mr. Waters has some cases there that I assume he'd like for me to look at, and and if you do, I'd be happy to look at what you have as well.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Nothing from the state, Your Honor.
Nothing from the defense, Your Honor.
Let's bring the jury.
The jury is present.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good
morning. Madam Forelady, how's the jury doing? Doing great. That's great news. Well, we're now in day number 22, defense's case. You may call your next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. Defense
called Mark Ball.
Truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
You got. It's okay. Have a seat on the stand.
Please adjust that microphone. You can speak into it. Just state your full name and spell your last name.
Mark Ball, B-A-L-L.
Mr. Ball, will you tell the jury a little bit about yourself? Where are you from? What do you do?
I'm a lawyer in Hampton. I practice with the Parker Law Group now. I've lived in Hampton for 20 plus years. I now live in Rum Gully here in Culloden County. Have for about 8 years, 9 years. I practice mostly
civil. How long have you been a lawyer?
33 years.
Okay, and where were you born and raised?
In Ballantyne, South Carolina, up above Columbia, about 20 miles.
And when did you move down to this part of the state?
I started with the law firm 34 years ago. I moved down. I was a law clerk at first and have never left since 1988.
Do you know the defendant, Alec Murdoch?
I do.
How long have you known him?
34 years.
And did you practice law together?
We did, about 20-something.
Did you become personal friends of his?
Yes, I mean.
And were your family friends with his family?
Yes, our children grew up together, as did everybody in the firm.
And your wife, Lisa, would she become good friends with Maggie?
Yes, sir.
Okay. On the, do you remember the evening of June the 7th?
I do very well.
2021?
Yes, sir.
How did you learn about the tragic murders of Maggie and Paul?
It was about 10:30, and one of my partners, Ronnie Crosby, tried to call my phone, and before I could get to it, he called my wife's phone, and hand marked the phone, and he said Maggie and Paul had been shot and get over there. And so I scrambled and got over there. I live about 8 or 10 miles from there. I live over in Rum Gully, and that's Moselle.
And why did you go over there?
To find out what was going on. To, you know, see what was, I mean, we're out in the middle of, you know, nowhere, and, you know, somebody calls you and says, your law partner's, you know, wife and child have been shot, you go. I mean.
And who did you go with?
I went with my wife, Lisa.
And when you got there, who was on the scene, do you recall?
Yeah, I came in by the cabin, what's referred to as the cabin side of it, and there was a ambulance was pulled up next to the what I would call the hangar building. It was pulled up there, and then Barry McRoy's vehicle, he drives a SUV of some type, and then there was a police car pulled off to the right-hand side, probably 50 yards before you get to them, and I pulled in right behind them on the left hand or the right hand side of the driveway coming in, and then walked over.
Will you remind the jury who Barry McCoy is?
Barry McCoy is the chief of the fire and rescue here in Culloden County.
So when you arrived, I think so Barry McCoy was present?
He was there. He was standing there speaking with a deputy, and there were two EMT paramedics standing over near their ambulance or.
And when you pulled into the lower driveway by the cabin, had any roadblocks or barriers been put up to stop cars from coming in there?
None. I got there about 10:50, 10:52, something like that.
Did you have a conversation with any law enforcement officers about the need to block the entrance?
I did eventually. I was talking to Barry about, I had found out just before I got there, somebody had called me, and they work with sort of the maintenance side of fire and rescue, and they had heard come across the radio that there were two dead. So I suspected that Paul and Maggie had passed away. So when I got there, I was talking to Barry and asking him some questions.
I could see Randy kind of through the alleyway between the dog kennel and the sort of wing shed that comes off of the hangar. And then Buddy Hill, the sheriff, came over, and then I spoke with him.
And did you talk about the need to block the entrance into the Moselle property off Moselle Road?
We did, just briefly. He said, I need to get this blocked off. And I think he took a phone call or something. And I walked back to tell my wife what was going on. And I saw another deputy coming in. So I walked out to the head of the road there. And I said, I think the sheriff wants this blocked off. And then I walked back to where Barry McRoy was. And then
did that entrance get blocked off?
No.
What happened?
People just kept piling in. Just more and more people kept showing up.
Roughly how many cars do you think piled in?
I don't know, because shortly thereafter I walked around to the other side, but there were a good many. When I walked back over there an hour and a half later, there were a good many cars over there.
And when you say you walked around the other side, I don't think we need a diagram, but just tell the jury what you're talking about.
Well, there's a dog pen. From where I was standing, the dog pen would be to the left. The aircraft hangar with two wing sheds coming off of it would be directly in front of me. There's a skin and shed that would be to the far right. And then directly across from the hangar shed, probably 50 or 60, 75 yards, would be another storage shed, equipment shed. And so I walked down almost to where the skin and shed was, and then back around in front of the far shed, okay, the equipment shed.
So you did not walk directly between the shed and the kennels?
No, sir.
You walked around the shed?
Correct.
Before you walked around the shed, did you stand and observe what was happening within the taped-off area?
I did. I mean, people were walking between the dog pen and the law enforcement, and responders had walked between the two areas, the wing shed and the dog kennel, and I could see where Paul was, but he was covered up. Barry had covered him up.
And what was the weather?
It was misty. It wasn't really raining, but it was one of those kind of foggy days or nights that it's more than just a fog. You get wet. And eventually it got where it would drizzle off and on, and later on it didn't rain hard, but it was intermittently sprinkle in that kind of floating heavy fog.
Did you make any observations about water coming off the roof of the kennel?
I did later on when I got around to that side.
Okay, and what observations did you make?
Eventually the water was running off. That dog kennel is built with a small cantilever on the front of it and then a longer part off the back. And water was dripping off of the front of the shed where Paul was.
Was water landing on Paul?
It was.
And could you see where the water would then accumulate after it landed on Paul?
It would drain off. There's a cement apron right there in the front of that feed room. And there was water there. There was water in the gravel to some degree.
Did
the grass was wet. I mean, it wasn't raining so hard that, you know, you couldn't just stand there without an umbrella, but it was drizzling enough that you were getting wet.
And the fact and the grass that you observed water dripping off the roof onto Paul's body, did that concern you?
It did. It did.
Why?
Well, one, I didn't think that, you know, it's a crime scene. You don't want just water dripping all over the place. But more importantly, I thought it was pretty disrespectful. I mean, Paul was a good young man, and I, quite frankly, it just pissed me off.
I understand. Did you have a conversation with anyone about trying to prevent that?
I don't think I did about that aspect of it, but it was, I just thought that they should have done put a tarp or something. I mean, just out of respect.
Right.
They eventually did with Maggie put a, what I would call a tailgating tent, very similar to the media tents that are out front, those little lightweight, and they put that over Maggie.
Right.
But to my knowledge, they never did over Paul, at least while I was there.
When you walked around the shed to get on the other side, who was on the other side?
Well, I could see through the alleyway between the dog kennels and that wing shed coming off of. If you were standing in front of the aircraft hangar, it'd be the right-hand side where Maggie was. I could see Randy over there and Alec. Alec, much more infrequently, but Randy was on the phone walking, and I could see him. And I think he and I got there about the same time. He had come through the main gate.
When you got up, what did you get up to greet Alec?
I did. When I walked around, Alec met me about halfway where that equipment shed is. Alec came, as soon as he saw me coming up through there, he met me about halfway in front of that shed and just went to pieces. He's Alec's 6'4", 6'5", whatever he is, and I'm 5'9". He pretty well smothers you when he hugs you.
Well, what was his demeanor?
He was devastated. I mean, he was crying. He was, I mean, just beside himself. And I told him we'd get through it.
And did
he? Go ahead.
Yeah. Eventually, did Sled arrived on the scene?
He did, but while Alec was...
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Kind of, you know, I'm trying to console him and patting him on the back, and, you know, he said, look at what they did to them. I mean, just right off the bat.
So during that initial encounter with Alec, he referred to they, look what they did, is that correct?
Yeah, they, which I didn't really think about at the time until I was taking my wife home. I just thought it was an odd comment.
The sled arrived sometime later?
They did.
Do you remember about how long after your initial arrival sled got on the scene?
I think they got, they came kind of in, you know, because I'm sure they were coming from various locations, but they were there probably within an hour and hour and a half of me being there.
And by the time sled arrived, were there other members from your law firm and family members out on the property where you were standing?
There were. By the time sled got there, pretty much all the lawyers in the firm, with the exception of maybe two or three, one of them had small children, and one got forgotten, and pretty much everybody that was a lawyer was there.
And
family members. All of Alec's family was there.
Were you directed to leave the area when sled started processing the crime scene?
Eventually we were. The coroner came over, Rich Harvey, came over and said sled was there. They were ready to start processing the scene. He said, y'all need to, you know, go over to the house. And I said, are you sure about that? And he said, yeah. And I said, are you sure it's okay for us to go to the house? And he walked back over and asked somebody and came back and said, yeah. And I said,
did you have any concerns going to the house?
I did.
What were your concerns?
Well, it was twofold. One, you know, this is a pretty big farm, and I don't know who's over there. Two people have been gunned down, and, you know, is it safe? You know, so safety's one concern, and the other is that part of what went on here? And so, where's the crime scene start and stop?
And when you got to the house, did it appear that the house had been searched and cleared in any form or fashion?
I didn't see any signs of that, but I'm not a criminologist, I'm not a prosecutor, I'm not a defense lawyer, but I mean, it looked like just a regular house.
Okay. But before you go to the house, did you have any conversations with law enforcement about, you know, your knowledge of Paul receiving threats?
Yeah, I had asked, when I was standing where I had driven up, Buddy Hill had come over there, and he asked me if I knew, because I know Sheriff Hill, and he asked if I had any idea of who might want to do this, and I said, not really. And he said, do you know of any threats? And I said, you know, I know Paul had gotten, since the boat wreck, that he had gotten several, you know, threats and just people cranking off from all over the place, not necessarily local, but from everywhere. And I would hear it from, you know, Alec from time to time and different, just different stuff. And so I told him that.
Did, when you had that conversation with Sheriff Hill, had you spoken to Alec?
I had not at that point. I hadn't gotten over to him.
When you had that conversation with Sheriff Hill, had you listened to the 911 call?
No, sir.
That that thought of threats, was that an independent thought of yours?
Well, it was response to a question.
Right.
From Sheriff Hill.
And your thought process was about the boating accident?
Well, that was the only threat that I knew of that Paul had ever encountered.
Right. When do you remember who went to the house when you went into the Moselle residence?
Yeah.
Who was with you?
Well, I mean, I probably can't name them all. I'll probably leave somebody off. But it was myself, Ronnie Crosby, Lee Cope, Austin Crosby, Neil, Alger, Randy Murdoch, Alec.
Had Buster gotten there yet?
Buster had gotten there, I believe, but I'm not sure. He and Brooklyn, I remember when they came up, but I can't tell you whether it was over before we left over there. It seems to me that they drove up at the house, but I can't tell you for certain. And then there was Corey Fleming and Chris Wilson showed up, Lynn, John Marvin, just a host of people. Greg Alexander, chief of police in the embassy, who's a friend of theirs, showed up.
There were a lot of people in the house.
A lot of people.
What did you observe of the condition of the house?
When we came in the door, we obviously went to the den, and we're standing around. The den and the kitchen in that house are connected, and there were pots on the stove, so Lee Cope and myself and I think Austin got the pots. I think I set something in the sink, and they stuck some in the refrigerator.
But when you entered the house, it looked like there was food out that had been prepared for dinner?
There was food on the stove, yeah. Okay. I don't recall seeing any plates, but somebody else could have picked them up. I wouldn't.
But were folks cleaning up?
Sure.
And what time of day was this?
It was probably 1:30 or 2 in the morning.
Do you remember what time you left the Moselle residence on that night, early morning?
I probably left at 3:30 or 4. I left when Alec was leaving.
When did you go back to the property?
I had a deposition the next morning, and I ended up having to take it, and then I got out there about 11, I guess.
And was Alec there when you got there?
I went over to the dog pen over that way. I had gotten a call that morning about 8 o'clock from Randy, 8 or 8:15, and John had gone over there trying to clean up and couldn't do it, I mean, emotionally. And
right.
Randy had asked me if I could see about finding somebody to come clean it up or did I know anybody. And I called the coroner's office to find out if they had people that did that type of work or knew of people that did that type of work, and ultimately the coroner called me back and gave me the names of two companies, and
okay.
I gave those to Lee, and he started trying to run them down.
Okay. I inadvertently skipped over something on my outline. When you were at the house before you left, so you left about 3:30 in the morning or so, were you there when SLED agents came up and took custody of Alec's clothes that he was wearing?
I was. They knocked on the door. Somebody answered the door. For for some reason I got up and walked over there, and they said they needed his clothes and to, I think, swab his hands. I walked back over. Alec had been sitting next to me on the couch. There's two couches in the den that sort of face each other, and then two chairs that are headed towards the kitchen. He was sitting on the far couch, and I walked back over and I said, Alec, they need your clothes. Can you step back here with these folks? Hello. And it was a male and a female.
Okay. Well, before we go any further, let me ask you, were your clothes wet or dry when you were sitting on the couch?
They were pretty, well, they were pretty wet. They weren't soaked, but they were uncomfortably damp.
And do you recall whether Alec's clothes were damp as well?
I would assume they are. I didn't reach over and...
And did you see how the clothes were, collected? Were they put on a hanger, wrapped up carefully, or what happened?
The male went into what Alec's bedroom, at least I'm assuming that's Alec's bedroom, and he came back out, and then I saw Alec just kind of, the female agent or officer was holding the bag, and Alec dropped him in.
There was one bag, multiple bags?
I thought it was one, but I couldn't tell you whether it was one or two or three.
All right. Went down, now I'm jumping back to where we were on the morning of June the 8th. After you got out of your deposition, did you go to the property?
I did.
And you went down to the kennels?
I did. I drove over there.
Had the crime scene been released?
It had been released, and because I asked Randy that morning, he said, yeah, they've released it when John was down there.
And what'd you do?
Well, I just wandered around. There was a sled agent there. I think at some point Duffy Stone and Sean, his deputy, Thornton, was there. And I think one of their investigators, they were over inside the hangar, and there was a sled agent. At least I'm presuming he was a sled agent. And I don't know who he was. It wasn't any of the ones that were working the case that I came to find out that were working the case later on that I can remember. And I looked around at different things.
Did you look in the feed room?
I did.
What did you see in the feed room?
Well, by that time, I think Ronnie had either come up or was over there.
Ronnie
Crosby.
Your law partner.
And I think Lee Cope was there as well, but I'm not sure about that. I'm pretty sure. And I was looking in the feed room, and you could see, you know, obviously there was still a pretty raw scene. And there were...
There still remains of Paul in the feed room that had not been collected?
At first I didn't see it. I saw shot, you know, on the floor, steel shot on the floor, number two.
Steel shot, you mean pellets from a...
Yeah, like bird shot, except it was number two, steel.
Okay, and you saw that in the feed room?
It was all over everything. It was on the floor, it was on the shelves, it was various places.
Okay.
And then I got to looking around, and there was you could see where a piece of buckshot had gone through, and you could see where it had knocked out, you know, or shot through twice where the window was, or is. Two had gone through that. There was some plastic crates or something, and you could see where one of the shot had gone through and had embedded in the window frame right there, the molding. And then there was a piece of buckshot laying on the ledge of the windowsill.
What did you do when you observed the shots?
I walked back out and asked what I thought was the agent. And
what was the agent?
He said, we've got all we need. And so I walked back over there and looked around, and then looking around down on around the floor and all that, there was a piece of Paul's skull about size of a baseball laying there.
Did that upset you?
It did, very much. I mean, it just really infuriated me. And I don't know who I was supposed to be mad at, but it just infuriated me that this young man had been murdered and there were still his remains there. And there was a large blood spot and tissue out right off of the apron of that area right outside the feed room that was there, and it's kind of like walking across the grave. You just, it's one of those things you just don't do.
Right.
After you spent time down at the kennel area, what'd you do next?
I ended up going back to the house, and I remember Terry Brandstetter, Aggie's daddy, was there, and several other people, and I spoke to them and went in the house, and eventually went towards where the gun room was that afternoon.
Did sled agents come up to search the house while you were present?
They did.
And I think the jury's seen a video of it. We don't need to play it, but were you present in the gun room?
I was. I think they probably 2:30 or 3 o'clock, something like that, they showed up. And I had had a discussion with that same agent. And I'm assuming it's a sled agent. It could have been a sheriff's deputy. But I made the assumption that it was a sled agent over at the kennels and the hangar. About, I asked if they'd figured out what kind of gun it was. And at that time, I assumed it was a 223 based on the night before. Barry McRoy had said that he thought it was some type of assault rifle. And I just immediately kind of went there. And that agent had said that it was a 3 something. And I said, a 300 blackout. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, there's one over there in the gun rack. And he said, no, there's not. And apparently Sled had been there sometime that morning or whatever. He said, they already checked, there's not one over there. And I said, yes, there is. And so later on when they got there, there was one there.
And you located it for Sled?
Yeah.
The night, early morning hours, 2 or 3 o'clock before you left, had you seen the gun room?
I had.
Were there guns on the pool table and whatnot?
I walked in there, the door was shut, I think. I think the door was shut between it and the sort of a transition hall. You go through there, and then there was a bathroom, and then where the freezers were, and then it exits out onto the porch. And then straight ahead would be, I guess in the original house plans, would have been a garage, but it was kind of a den game room that Alec had turned into a recreation slash gun room and large room. And I walked in there, and there were 3 shotguns on the table, pool table.
Right.
And some other stuff, some shells and stuff. And
when you went back the next day, the 8th, daylight hours, early afternoon, it looked like things had been put up.
They had been put up. There were no guns on the table. There were no shells, no nothing there. And so I asked what happened to that. And I was told that the maid had put them up. And so I went and asked her.
Was it Blanca?
And yeah, I went to Blanca and she said, yeah, I was told to clean up the room. And so I put them up and put them in the rack.
Okay. And did you point out to the sled agents the guns that were on the table that you thought you'd seen the night before?
I didn't point out the guns. I told them that there had been guns there.
When you're on the property, on the, I guess the morning, on the 8th at some point in time, did you observe an employee that had been working on the property for Alec, individual by the name of C.B. Rowe?
I did.
And did you take pictures of his vehicle for some reason?
I took pictures of a vehicle. I didn't know whose vehicle it was. There was a vehicle that had pulled up underneath of the, again, if you were standing in front of the hangar where the big door is, it would have been to the right. And there was a truck that had pulled up in there and it didn't have a license tag on it. And when I walked by it, there was a jug of Clorox and I can't remember what else was in there, but it was a jug of Clorox, and I just thought that was odd.
Where was the Clorox?
It was in the bed of the truck.
Okay.
And I took a couple of pictures of it and turned them over to Sled.
And why did you take pictures?
It just looked odd. You know, two people had gotten killed, and, you know, there's Clorox around.
Okay. There's been some, I won't make a statement. Did you see any coolers on the property down there?
I did.
Where did you see a cooler?
When I walked around the bottom part near the, between the skin and shed and the hangar and the other shed, there was a open cooler there, or looked like a Yeti style cooler, and I can't tell you whether it's a Yeti or not, but it was one of those thicker coolers, and there was probably a dozen beer cans around it that night, and the next day when I walked by it, it was still there.
Okay.
I just thought it, with all the people and the hoopla that had gone on, that it didn't look very good.
Okay. Did you, I mean, was that the only thing that stood out about the cooler, the beer cans around?
The beer cans, yeah.
Okay.
Looked like somebody had unloaded a boat or something.
Right.
And just kind of thrown them out of the boat and forgot about them and left it.
Did, what kind of law do you practice?
Civil.
Okay. Plaintiffs, defense?
Mostly plaintiffs. Occasionally I'll defend a, you know, small business or a farmer or something like that, but
right.
For the most part, it's all plaintiffs.
During the course of your practice, have you had experience with getting cell phone records of, you know, parties to find out information?
I have. It's pretty regular now. I mean, just about every defense lawyer asks and every plaintiff's lawyer asks, because so many people are texting and talking on the phone when they rear end somebody or crash into somebody or whatever, and you want to know if you ask them, were you on the phone, and they say no, and, you know, it shows up on the bill, then they probably were on the phone.
And as, you know, part of your, I guess, concern about Maggie and Paul and Allie, did you pull his cell phone records?
Well, I was asked to pull them, and yeah, we provided them to both SLED and to your office, I believe.
Right.
For Alex cell phone records.
And if you're trying to get information from an opposing party or something about cell phone records, are the records more reliable than the actual handheld phone device?
Objection, Your Honor.
In your experience?
401-402.
Did you hear the objection?
I didn't.
So if it's a lawyer, then you know you don't respond until the court rules. Response to the objection.
There's been testimony about deleted call logs, Your Honor, and this addresses that issue.
Anything further? Objection's overruled.
I don't know that aspect of it. That's a technical. I get the records because they're more accessible than getting a download and going through the. There are cases that you may want to get a download, but the run-of-the-mill cases with truck wrecks and stuff, the records of the cell phone call records tend to answer the question that I'm asking.
You've known Alec for 30-plus years?
Yes, sir.
You recognize his voice?
Yes, sir.
And I think at one point in time, were you asked to identify his voice on a video of down the kennel?
Yes, sir.
And did you do so?
Yes, sir.
And you determined it was Alec's voice?
Alec and Maggie and Paul.
And you told that to SLED?
Yes, sir.
Have you listened to a tape that's been played in this courtroom about whether Alec said, I did him so bad or they did him so bad?
Objection.
401-402 and beyond the scope of this witness's knowledge.
Objection overruled.
I was sent a snippet and asked the question.
Okay.
What it was and.
But hang on, I'm not getting your response. So let's, Your Honor, we'd like to play the snippet from State's Exhibit 153 for this witness.
Your witness.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And, Your Honor, I would object. I believe that this witness was not present for this conversation, and, again, would object under 401 and 402 in relevance to his commentary on that particular exhibit.
Objection's overruled.
And sitting in the pocket today, it's just so bad.
Sounds like they to me.
Right.
I played the snippet multiple times. And
is it consistent with what he told you the night of the murders?
It is.
You remember in, I think, February 2019 that Paul Murdoch was involved in a boating accident?
I do.
And you're aware that he was criminally charged?
I am.
And then Alec, and I believe Buster, were civilly sued?
Yes, sir.
And did you work on the case formally?
No, not formally, no. I was about to get in after the murders, along with several other partners.
Did, leading up to the murders, did you have conversations with Alec about civil case and the criminal case?
I did about the civil case to begin with. And then when the charges came out, I talked with he and Randolph.
What was Alec's, if you know, what he expressed to you his priority between the two matters was?
Well, obviously the criminal matter was much more pressing for him.
And in your conversations with him, did you gain an understanding of his concern about the civil case?
Yeah, somewhat.
How concerning was the civil case?
Well, I mean, obviously, anytime you get sued, you've got to be concerned about it. And, you know, it was the whole boating accident as a whole was very negative towards him, towards Paul, and the entire family, or his entire family. And so, you know, it was obviously it wasn't a nothing, but at the same time, I read the complaint, several partners and my lawyers in my firm read the complaint, and at the time that he was sued, the causes of action against Alec were drafted probably to try to get as much insurance coverage as they could, which is what you do as a plaintiff's lawyer. You're looking for coverage. You don't want to make allegations that get you out of coverage. And it was very vanilla against him. And the allegations against Alec were that I sort of referred to him, and others did as well, as sort of bad parenting. You had a adult child that the allegation was that you allowed him to go out and drink, and when you're 18, you pretty much get to do what you want, and you've reached your majority. And so I thought it was very defensible as to that, those causes of action at that time, or that cause of action.
Sure.
And I think he did too, but I don't know what he thought.
Right. Did it, some point in time, Alec, was he forced to resign from the firm?
He was. September the 3rd.
What day was it?
September the 3rd.
And after that, did you have an opportunity to look in his office?
I did. He resigned on the 3rd. Then there was the incident on the 4th. And I left the scene over there on Old Salkehatchie and went by the office. And I'd also been in his office on Friday after he resigned.
When you were in his office, did you find any paperwork that looked like he had been working on for the boating case?
Not until the 5th.
Okay, and what paperwork did you find on the 5th?
The 5th, I went in and started really, because we have an obligation to those clients that he was representing, and I didn't want files just laying around. This was Labor Day weekend. All this hoopla and emotion of, you know, the murders, the issues with Alec leaving the firm, and then that Saturday. And so that Sunday I went in to the office and went to his office and started going through to make sure that any client files were put over in stack, you know, over there. And as I was going through, I found checks that he had deposited with his telephone that were some of the funds that sort of started all this mess with the Ferris case. They were laying, one was on his top of his desk, one was in a drawer. I pulled out one of the drawers and there was a tablet, a legal tablet, that had numbers written down on it as far as debts and assets and, you know, just kind of a scribblings of kind of what you owe and what you've got.
Would it be something that you would normally see on a net worth statement?
It would be the same information. When I think of a net worth statement, I think of the form that a bank sends you.
Right.
But yeah, it obviously, he was listing what he had and what he owed.
And is it something, the type of format you've seen in civil litigation where a defendant's required to produce net worth?
Not in the same form, but the same information.
I skipped another topic. After Maggie and Paul's death, did you collect her jewelry?
I did. I got a call on the Wednesday, I believe, after the murders on Monday, from the coroner. His wife and my wife had worked as surgical nurses at Hampton Hospital together, and then my wife ended up being the supervisor over that area, and I then, so I knew them very well, and I'd known Rich for 30 years. He called and said that Lori had cleaned up the jewelry and, you know, whenever Alec wanted it, and I said, well, I'll come get it. And so I met him, Ronnie Crosby, and I came over to his office and picked it up, signed for it, and I carried it back to the house.
And within the jewelry, do you remember the wedding ring and wedding bands and other jewelry?
There were rings. I can't tell you. I didn't. There was the thing that sticks out to me was she had a diamond bracelet on, and it was in pieces.
Right.
And he said he tried to find all the pieces, but there were still some missing.
Okay.
But I wasn't paying attention so much to. It didn't feel right looking and snooping around in somebody else's stuff.
Knowing Alec for 30 years, do you develop an assessment of his relationship with his family, Maggie, Paul, and Buster?
Well, I'll tell you this. The person I thought I knew loved his family, or appeared to love his family very much. He'd take their calls. He'd do all of those things. After, you know, September the 3rd, I'm not sure I know that person. And so, but he always seemed to be devoted to everything. Their ball games, he would aggravate the hell out of me when you'd be in a deposition and they would call and he'd answer it, and, you know, you'd be in a meeting or whatever, and he always took their calls. Whereas my wife and my children never called me unless it was a true emergency. And Alec took their calls, whether it was they needed, you know, a gallon of milk, or, you know, they had something important to tell him. I mean, he always took their calls.
And did you see them together frequently?
I did. They went places. You'd see pictures of them. I think Maggie was a pretty prolific Facebook, text, whatever. I'm not on any social media, but my daughter or my wife would show me pictures of where they had been, or ball games, different things like that. I never saw anything that indicated to me that there was anything out of the way with any of the relationships, including the the drug stuff. I had no...
Yeah, let me ask you, were you aware that he had an opioid addiction?
None.
And any of the, were any of the partners aware that he had opioid?
None to my knowledge. I mean, that was not a, not a subject matter that ever came up. I mean, it was... Right. And, you know, Paul, I think, has been sort of demonized by this whole affair, and it's not fair. I mean, Paul, it's like a lot of young people I know, you know, they kind of are trying to find where the fence is. Sometimes they get, you know, going a little fast and, you know, blow through some things. But Paul was a good kid. He was always polite to me. I never had one single solitary issue with him at all. And I knew he had done some things, you know, that most kids, you know, are mischievous, do, and on at least one occasion I went to Alec and told him that I thought Paul needed to be throttled back a little bit, that I saw some videos of him driving fast. And I don't know what Alec did, but that was, our firm was very much of a family. I mean, if you were a member of our firm, and it didn't matter whether you were a lawyer or one of our folks, I mean, our staff is family as well, and if they have a problem, we all have a problem. And so we look out for each other, and we did. Unfortunately, Alec betrayed that when he stole the money.
Sure.
And, but, you know, the outward things that I saw of Alec with his kids and his wife were just that. I mean, they were what I observed. Not, nobody knows what goes on behind closed doors, but they
sure.
They seemed to enjoy each other's company.
All right.
Thank you. Course and don't.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Waters?
Please, court.
Mr. Waters, could I steal one of your waters there?
Absolutely.
There you go.
He was pretty good at hiding who he really was, wasn't he?
Obviously.
You known him for 34 years?
I knew him for 34 years, or I have known him for 34 years.
Thought y'all were pretty good friends?
Thought so.
Interacted many times a week?
We had his son Buster and my daughter were in school all the way from kindergarten on, and I would see him at work some, you know, early on. He didn't work for us immediately when he came out of law school. He worked for Jim Moss and Moss and Coon, and then he came to us about 5 or 6 years after that.
But you've shared a business with him for how long?
Probably 20 some odd years.
He was your partner?
He was a partner.
You trusted him?
You have to. And I did.
And outwardly, to your appearance, he was a good lawyer. He was a partner to you. He was someone you could trust and rely on, wasn't he?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first
outwardly,
part.
From what you observed.
Yes, sir.
He was a good partner. He was a good lawyer. He was someone in part of your business, somebody that you could trust and rely on. Is that true?
Yes, he was.
And outwardly, you thought that he had a good relationship with his family. Is that correct?
That is correct.
But you have just testified that you didn't really know this man, did you?
Obviously, I did not. I mean, had we known the things he was doing, we wouldn't have been law partners.
You were asked about the kennel video.
Yes, sir.
And you've had a chance to review that kennel video?
A couple of times.
And you and I have talked quite a few times, is that correct?
We have. I didn't see the kennel video until probably a month or two ago.
And but you've reviewed it here recently, is that correct?
I have, several times.
All right. And any doubt in your mind that Alec Murdoch, Maggie, and Paul were on that kennel video at 8:44 p.m. on June 7th, 2021?
None.
No doubt in your mind?
No doubt.
Do I need to play it for you again, or no doubt in your mind?
I played it all. I want to hear it.
Well, let's talk about that just a little bit. And we'll talk more in some detail, but I want to go ahead and cover this. You saw Alec the night of the murders.
I did.
And you knew Maggie very well, and you knew Paul very well.
I did.
And you went to the scene where Alec was, is that right?
I did.
And did you even ride with Alec or take Alec back over to the house?
I'm pretty sure he rode back over to the house. He and I think he and Randy, because their vehicles were impounded over there.
And did you eventually, as things started to move forward, sit down on the couch with him back at the house?
I did.
Fix yourself a liquor drink?
Probably a heavy one.
I get it. And did you talk to Alec about what he did that night?
I don't know whether it was... I know on the couch we talked, but I talked to him several times, including before the masses got there, as to trying to figure out, do you know anything? Do you know, have any idea who did this?
Because you were very concerned. You want to get to the bottom of this, right?
Well, for a lot of reasons.
For a lot of reasons. For the family, for what happened to Maggie and Paul, for the law firm, for all the people involved.
All of it. I mean, safety of, you know, if it was something to do with him and the law practice, we didn't want somebody to show back up at the front door and harm our folks. We didn't want them to harm any of the other lawyers' families. If it was some person that was deranged, we just didn't know. I mean, this isn't an ordinary occurrence in your practice of law.
You thought you were his buddy, been partners for 34 years. Y'all are sitting on the couch, is that right?
Like family.
And you start talking to him. Is he responding to your questions appropriately?
He was.
Answering the correct subject matter?
He was. He was very upset, obviously.
Sure. I mean, but he was answering your questions. He wasn't unable to make sentences.
He was. Yeah.
And did you talk to him about what he did that night?
Yeah.
And did he deny ever going down to those kennels to his buddy and law partner of 34 years?
He said that he ate dinner, laid down on the couch, took a nap, and then left to check on him.
And now you know that's not true from seeing the kennel video, right?
I do.
And that wasn't the only time he told you that, is it?
No, at least three times.
At least three times. And this would be over the subsequent days?
Yes, sir.
Subsequent conversations that you had with him?
Yes, sir.
And he was always clear that he never went down to those kennels after they ate dinner?
It was the same version of it, but it wasn't always just me.
Okay, and we'll talk about that. Who else was present in some of those conversations?
Well, I mean, there were other law partners, and I can't tell you exactly who all was there, but I mean, I know on that Thursday following this, I heard him say it then.
Okay, and there were other law partners there?
Yes.
Were their family there?
I don't know whether they were in the room at the time or not. I just know there were law partners there.
Was Jim Griffin there?
I can't speak as to what... He was present on the property, but I don't know whether he was there.
And did Alec tell the same version of events, that he never went down to those kennels?
Yeah, he did, but I don't know whether Mr. Griffin was there. We were there before Mr. Griffin was there.
Did, in his conversations with you, did he ever change his story about who he checked first at the scene? Supposedly?
I've heard it both ways, and I don't know whether it's just a... I don't know whether it's just because of the trauma of the situation, but one time it was... the first time I remember, he checked Maggie first and then went to Paul, and then I heard him say at one point that it was Paul and then it was Maggie. It didn't really matter to me. It wasn't something I really was picking up on, because it was horrendous either way. I mean, I can't imagine seeing my wife dead and my son dead in such a brutal manner. So I never put any real stock in that. But it did. It oscillated.
It did oscillate from what he was saying?
From the first time I heard it. But
the story changed.
Well, yeah, as to which was which.
Over the days following this event, this law firm, as you said, was like a family, right?
It was.
You thought you were very close to this man, just like you feel close to your other law partners and their families and the staff and everybody else.
It wasn't just the lawyers that felt that way. It was, I mean,
The paralegals.
The paralegals were there. Yeah. The law firm shut down. They were also on, we had to go on a heightened alert. I contacted SLED about what we should be doing because there was a statement that came out about there was no, they didn't know of any danger to the public. And we're left with trying to make sure that the 60 or 75 people that work with us are all safe and they go home to their families. And SLED responded. I called the lieutenant over here and he called me back that evening and, you know, was very helpful as far as trying to tell us, you know, he said, I don't know of any specific threats, but, you know, here's some precautions and I think what y'all are doing is the right thing. And they were helpful. And, but there was still that undertow of, you know, who did this and are they going to, and it just, people were just on edge all the time.
And you're not a criminal lawyer or prosecutor, I think you said.
I'm not.
But still a lawyer. And so you and your partners, including his brother Randy, were very focused on trying to figure out what happened here. What is wrong here, correct? What happened sure. on June 7th, 2021, sure. right? Very focused on that, were you not?
We were. I mean, it was taking a lot of time off.
But he was not, was he? You've said that before, have you not?
I have said that, but I don't know, Mr. Waters, how I would respond if I'd lost, and I've told you the same thing. I don't know how you're supposed to react when you lose your wife and your child in such a brutal manner. But no, to answer your question, I didn't see him on the phone like I was trying to call clients and did you hear anything? Did you see anything? Those kinds of things. So, I mean, the answer is no, I didn't see him doing that. I wasn't around him all the time, but no, I did not.
And you've already testified that you and other law partners and family and staff were very concerned about potential threats because of what happened on June 7th, is that right?
Very concerned.
And you thought it odd, though, that he was not concerned about any threats even to Buster, correct?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. The night that this happened, I asked Alec where Buster was, and he said, we've gotten a hold of him, Brooklyn's bringing him. And I said, are you sure he's all right? And he said, yeah, he's riding with Brooklyn. And I said, you think he needs any protection or something along those lines? I don't know that it was exactly those words. And he said, he'll be here in a little while, he'll be fine. But he was so addled, I didn't hang anything on anything Alec was saying.
But after that, in the days that followed, you continued to interact with him. He never asked for any protection or expressed any concern about protection for Buster, did he?
Not to me, he did not.
Not to you.
And, you know, the only thing I can tell you is the 4th of July, he came to Ronnie Crosby's house, and he had a pistol in his bag, which was, to me, was unusual. And, of course, in classic Alec, Buster, and Paul style, he ended up leaving the bag there when they left.
This law firm's been in existence how long?
1910. Was. We're no longer.
I'm sorry?
We're no longer. We're no longer.
It was until he came along, right? Until all this happened, right?
Until September of 2021.
September of 2021. And was a relative of Alex, his great-grandfather was part of that initial law firm, is that right?
His great-grandfather was the beginning of that law firm.
And was he also the solicitor for the 14th Circuit for this area of the state?
He was from, I believe, 1920 until 1940 when he was killed in a train accident.
Right. And then did the defendant's grandfather become solicitor?
Buster started.
The chief prosecutor for this area?
Buster took over in 1940 and was the solicitor until 1946, and then Randolph was appointed by the governor, and then was until he was 72.
And his father became solicitor, is what you just said, is
right,
that right?
Randolph.
Until about when?
Randolph was 82 when he passed away, so 10 years ago maybe. around there, and Buster became, Buster left the solicitor's office in 86 when he became 72. At the end of 86, beginning of 87, I think Randolph took over, and Buster became the assistant solicitor.
All right. And how long was Randolph solicitor?
Until about 10 years ago. And was still an assistant when he passed, I believe.
Do what?
I believe he was still an assistant solicitor.
Mr. Randolph was?
He was.
And so was the defendant, too, wasn't he?
He was, in some form or fashion.
He had a badge. Did you ever see a badge that he had?
I did.
Where did he keep that badge that you saw?
Usually it was on the corner of his dashboard.
Driving around with it in front of his dashboard?
A lot of times, yeah.
This family is very, very powerful, were they not? Very influential in this community?
I mean, they had a very good name. They had, you know, they were known to help you with your problems.
How important was that family legacy to the defendant?
Very, or seemed to be very important.
I think you've said that it was more important to him than anybody else that you observed.
It seemed that way. I mean, whenever there would be discussions of name changes or anything, he would be very involved in that, much more involved in that than he would be in other business matters.
And he even talked to you about wanting, that being the defendant, wanting to be solicitor as well.
At one time, yeah.
You talked a little bit about the scene. And there were, when you arrived, there were other law partners there as well. Is that right?
Not when I arrived. Randy was there.
Randy was there. Other law partners showed up.
They showed up over the next hour and a half or so.
Okay.
From Jasper County, from Buford, from all over.
And there were a lot of powerful attorneys at that scene as it was being processed, including the defendant. Is that right?
Well, obviously, Alec was there and the rest of us. And then I don't know of any other lawyers at the scene other than us being our firm members.
And was law enforcement always polite and respectful during this entire process?
Absolutely.
And when they came to the house that day, the video where the Jeff Croft came in and searched for those guns, were they polite and respectful?
They were very polite.
Did they have a long conversation because they knew family was in the house about trying to do this as delicately as they can without upsetting everybody and doing some big search and running everybody out of the house and all that stuff?
Katie, and I can't remember her last name, she offered to take off all of her identification, her gun and all of that, and we told her that wasn't necessary. Okay, I can
speak a little louder.
Okay, sure. That's
you
usually
scoot
not
up
a problem
a little bit, it might help, so you don't have to lean forward.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, they, I mean, Katie offered to really, you know, be very behind the scenes, so to speak. And everybody, I've not had, you know, the vast majority of them have been extremely polite and very, very responsive to anything that we ask.
Because of all the family there and the tragedy that happened, they were very delicate and respectful of that when they came to the house that day. Is that correct?
In looking back, they probably were too much.
But they were.
They were very.
You said that Alec would always ride in his Suburban with that badge up in the front dashboard, to your observation, right?
I don't know that he always did, but
a lot of the time. He also generally carried a pistol in the car too, didn't he?
I didn't know that. I can't testify.
But you've heard that now, haven't you?
I've heard that, but I didn't know that.
What was Alec like with the cell phone? He was on it all the time, wasn't he?
He was on the cell phone all the time.
He would constantly be using it, constantly responding to calls, in the middle of conversations, always had it with him, to your observation, being his law partner for 30-some-odd years. Is that correct?
He was an obnoxious user of the cell phone.
And would it have been unusual for him to go down to those kennels without his cell phone with him?
I mean,
you said that, haven't you?
I don't know whether I've said it or not said it, but I would think it would be unusual for Alec to go anywhere without his phone.
What was he like as a lawyer? Was he a very academic or type lawyer, or were his skills elsewhere?
Well, I mean, Alec was a very good lawyer. I mean, he got good results for his clients. He got, you know, he could look at a set of facts and really do well with them, figuring out where to go with the issues, where to push and where to not push and pull. And he was very good tactically. I wouldn't say that I'm a great academic lawyer. I think I'm pretty good at figuring out where the seams are to figure out the solution. And I think Alec was much more like I am in that respect, as far as looking at facts and talking with people. Alec never met anybody that he couldn't talk to. He could talk to a fence post.
Talk to a fence post. I think you've said that people were his trade.
They were.
And he understood the emotions of cases very well, did he not?
He did.
And he could be very convincing with people, as you've come to find out from what all that you've uncovered. Is that correct?
Absolutely. He convinced us since 2006.
Effortlessly and easily lied to you for years, and you didn't know it.
Didn't
Is
know
that
it.
Correct?
Didn't know it and didn't catch it. In fact, the way he was doing it was very, very cunning.
Cunning. Who is that? Remind the jury who Jeannie Seckinger is. It's been a long trial, but remind them who she is.
She is our in-house accountant, CFO. She's the money person, but she goes beyond that. She did management stuff. She would be the person that at one time she was kind of managing the non-lawyer staff, but she could still rein in the lawyers as well.
And in the wake of all this financial stuff that came up on September 4th, she was one of the ones tasked with going through and figuring out the extent of what he had done. Is that correct?
She and I worked a lot.
And you worked on that as well. Is that correct?
Correct. One of the things that has come up, and there was this issue that happened back in 2017 where we had, at the beginning of the year, the law firm depletes all the money, and then you have to start off the year. Well, money's coming in, and you may not have enough to cover your bills in January and February. So we do a loan, and generally the partners, ones that wanted to participate, would put money in, and then they'd get paid back as soon as we got on a cash positive in the new year. And there was an issue in 2017 where Alec was paid. He didn't put the money in, but the check was written to him by mistake. Mm-hmm. And I've gone back and looked at it and made sure. But his name and Randy's name appeared at one over the other, and it was just a fat finger or just a missed thing with the mouse. And the check was generated to Alec. And then there was a second check generated, one in March, one in April. The one check was negotiated in May, I think. The other check stayed on his desk and was negotiated the next October. Well, what that did was that threw out and this is in our operating account. It wasn't client money. So it threw our operating account out of balance. And when we started looking at it, then we realized that he wasn't the one that was supposed to have gotten paid. We had basically a powwow. Our president, Danny Henderson, went to him, talked to him about it, and Alec swore that it was just a mistake, and he paid back the money with interest because Randy had been out of his money.
Paid it back with stolen money, correct?
Well, I didn't know that, but I mean, he paid it back, and I think there had been testimony that somehow that got swept under the rug. It did not get swept under the rug at all. It was investigated, but everything seemed to make sense because the check was written to him. He cashed a check that was written to him, and well, I might know whether or not I had an extra $123,000 or whatever it was, or $21,000. Alec always seemed just sort of disheveled with his own funds, so it made enough sense, and it there wasn't enough there to get in a brouhaha and you know, terminate somebody or create more of a fuss than it was, but it wasn't swept under the rug. Everything seemed to fall into place at the time. Now, obviously, had we known any of the other stuff at the time that we found out in September, then it would have been a different story.
But bottom line is, he got discovered. Oops, it was a big mistake, he says. He pays it back, and people move on, right?
And that was in 2018.
That was in 2018. And we're talking about the check written that was supposed to go to his brother that went to him instead.
Right.
And he was never one to loan money for those operating expenses generally. Is that right?
I think he loaned once or twice. It wasn't regular.
Right. And not around this time period, correct?
I didn't go back and look at that part of it.
It was $125,000 or roughly something like that?
$125,000.
All right.
I was more concerned about how it happened to begin with. Randy's initials are RM, and Alec's initials in our system are RAM. So that was...
And what he did was he gets that check, and instead of saying, this isn't $120,000 for me, he actually goes to staff a couple days later and says, I lost that check. Cut me another one, right?
Yes, sir.
And then he cashes that one, right?
He eventually cashes...
He cashes the
first
second one.
Yeah,
in pretty short order, correct?
He cashes the first one in October of the next year.
And then sits on the other one for an extended period of time and then cashes that one, right?
He did.
Steals the same money twice, right?
Yes, sir.
What was the word you used before, cunning?
Very cunning.
And you mentioned that it wasn't swept under the rug, but he said, oh, it was a big mistake, and he pays the money back, and then people move on, even though they, because, okay, it's just Alec, that sort of thing, correct?
Correct.
But there are other instances like that, too, over the years. For example, using private planes for personal use and billing that to the firm, is that right? Explain
some of that, but the biggest thing was the credit cards using, he just wasn't a very good rule follower at all. But he,
with other people's money, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, anytime you're in a law firm or you're working for somebody and you've got a card or a check that's got their name on it, then you owe them a responsibility to spend it properly. And
it's other people's money, right?
It's other people's money.
Okay. And he would spend personal use on the credit cards, and y'all would have to talk to him about that, right?
Yes, sir.
And that was going on repeatedly, correct?
Up until the end.
Put tuition on a firm credit card for one of his children, correct?
He did.
I had to talk to him about that, right?
Yes, sir.
And he'd pay it back, and then people would move on, right? And that had been going on for years, had it not?
It had, but there were other people that would...
But not like him, right?
Not to that
degree. Not like him.
Not to that degree.
Now, you talked a little bit about the boat case. But back in May of 2021, Jeannie came to you and told you about what Annette had discovered about them receiving the expense check in the Ferris case, but not the fee check, right?
Sometime in that time frame, yes.
And your initial concern was, and you were concerned that he was going to try to hide assets because of the boat case. That was part of your concern, and the firm was not going to participate in that if that's not if that was what was going on.
That's correct, that he was either going to structure them or leave them in somebody else's trust account until it had passed. I mean, we weren't going to fudge our books for that benefit.
And you were aware that in the boat case, they were seeking a personal recovery against Allen, correct?
Yes, sir.
And that caused you concern because this firm was not going to participate in helping him hide assets because of this boat case, correct? That was your concern.
He or anybody else.
Or anybody else. And you had continued conversations with Jeannie over the next few weeks about this because she couldn't get a straight answer as to what he had done with those fees, correct?
Myself and Jeannie and at least two other partners.
Lee Cope. And another partner?
And Ronnie Crosby.
And couldn't get a straight answer, could you?
Well, we weren't getting a straight answer, we continued, but we didn't want to make it a big deal if it wasn't a big deal, but because we didn't have the information, we couldn't make a decision.
And then on June 7th, 2021, Jeannie went in there to demand that straight answer, correct?
Yes, sir. I didn't know that until June the 8th.
But you knew it was coming to a head, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, Jeannie's tenacious. I mean, she's going to get to the answer. She's not going to let go until, and it wouldn't just be this. It would be anything.
But unlike the other times, Alec didn't have the money to pay it back and make it all go away, did he, this time?
I didn't know that.
But you know that now, don't you?
Well, yeah, obviously. The whole world does.
Maggie was your friend?
Who?
Maggie was your friend?
She was all of our friends, yes.
Paul was your friend?
Sure. He was dear friends with particularly my youngest daughter.
He was a good kid?
He was a good kid. I mean, he had his issues like everybody else. I mean, I don't know anybody that's raised children. If they say they're perfect, then they need to write a book. But, I mean,
I don't think any of us want to be judged by what we did when we were 18 or 19, do we?
I don't want to be judged with what I did, or I really don't want to be judged with how I raised my children. But, those are individual decisions. But, Paul was a good kid. He was always polite. I could have picked up the phone and called Paul and said, hey, I need some help over here on my farm. That kid would have come in a heartbeat. He was just a good kid. Now, did he do some devilish things? Absolutely. I hear about him, and occasionally if I saw him, I'd say something to him about it. But he was a good kid. I mean, he great outdoorsman. He grew a garden. I mean, Randolph, who they called handsome, I mean, he'd do anything in the world. And after the boat wreck, the two of them were almost glued together. And I mean, it's just a total waste of a kid that had never found his potential yet, but would have, I'm quite confident.
And after this tragedy happened to the family that was this law firm, everybody was focused solely on that, coming to support one another and coming to support Alec Murdaugh. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And the last thing on anyone's mind at that time was those dadgum Ferris fees when this happened. Isn't that right? And you've said that.
We actually, at least myself and one or two others, said, well, we'll have to put that on hold. I mean, it was a conscious, it wasn't just a, we're not going to, subconsciously, but we consciously said, we're going, a man just lost his wife and child. There's no way we're going to be cruel. We'll get back to it later. And we did.
Got back to it later. A couple months later, right? Or a month later.
A month later.
You're advised that, oh, wait a minute. Chris Wilson says he has those fees all along, right?
It's what I was told.
Because in the wake of those murders, he had managed to borrow some money from Johnny Parker, right?
I found that out later.
And he had managed to have Palmetto State Bank, through Russell Lafitte, give him $350,000 in undocumented funds, correct?
I found that out later as well.
Just after like before, you get an email saying, yeah, I'm Chris Wilson, I got the fees. And that kind of put the matter to bed at that point in time, right?
That was in July, yes.
Paid it back again, or at least you think. And just like before, people move on because you're still dealing with the tragedy of this terrible set of murders, correct?
By July, we were dealing with that and still this idea of the boat wreck, you know, and what he was going through. I mean, you rally around your family and your friends.
You rally around him, right?
Yeah. And that's not to any way throw cold water on any of the claims of the people in the boat wreck,
sure.
But everybody deserves a defense, and you know, you defend your friends and your family,
sure.
But you do it morally and honestly.
It's what people who think their friends do, right?
You hope they do.
September 3rd, or thereabouts, Annette finds this Chris Wilson check in Alex's office, right?
September the 2nd, I believe.
September 2nd, thank
you. Yeah.
States 313.
I can't see that far.
Sorry.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll take a recess at this time. Please go to the jury room. Please do not discuss the case. Please do not discuss your testimony. Yes, sir.
Going to the courtroom, I want to understand there's no order, disrespect to the court. We have our next two witnesses. We have our next two witnesses. We want to make sure we were ready to go as soon as this witness comes down. So as you see me coming and going, I'm just ensuring the witness is let in the front door and put somewhere. So
yes,
I apologize. It's no disrespect to the court.
How much more you have for this witness, you think?
20 minutes, Your Honor.
20 minutes. Then you don't know. So we don't know. Okay.
Thank you.
It'll be 10 minutes.
That wraps up the first segment of coverage. Here on day 20 in the trial of Alex Murdaugh, there is much more to come. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of it. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.